If you are joining us this week and weren't here last week, we are in a series called Life Together. And as I was doing some study of kind of the state of the union as far as Canada is concerned, I realized that this idea of life together is a bit of a misnomer. Meaning this, the percentage of Canadians living alone has risen drastically over the years. In 1951, just 2% of the Canadian population lived alone. 1951. As of the last census that was taken in 2016, that's the last official data we have, and it's been collected and compiled, we've gone from 2% in 1951 to 28% in 2016. Now, we understand, of course, that some of that is demographics, and they're shifting, you know, we're getting older as a group, as a country, but it still doesn't explain exactly why people are choosing to live alone. And we're not alone as a nation to have this happen. In the European Union, for instance, a third of all people live alone. And in Sweden, it's the highest country right now of people living alone at 52%. That's over half the people in the adult population live by themselves. So, like I said, this isn't necessarily good versus bad. Some people just like their own space, and I understand that. Someone like my mom lives alone. She's mid-60s, and yet she is the most social party girl that I know. She has two different life groups, and she goes out to this social group on once a month brunch, and I can't keep up with where she's going all the time. But there is something to be said for this idea of living alone and this feeling of isolation. So in thinking about how do we fix this, how do we address this, there have been actually some creative ways that people have thought about. It's not a government-mandated program that has changed things. It's actually people joining together and doing something about it. Last month on The National, there was this segment of these three women that decided to do something different about it, and I want to watch this for, I think it's a two-minute clip. Let's watch.
It might be cold outside.
Icicles? Mm.
But inside, there's easy laughter and a festive mood among three old friends.
Oh, yeah, that's perfect.
This year, for the first time, they're doing something different, spending Christmas together under the same roof.
We didn't like living alone anymore. You didn't laugh very much.
I didn't mind being alone at times. Mm-hmm. But then there are those other times when you think, oh, I wish I had someone to talk to.
This is my room.
So to fight that feeling of isolation and loneliness, these baby boomers decided it was time to give their living arrangement a reboot. They each sold their own houses, pooled their finances, and by the summer were moving into their new home in London, Ontario.
What was the motivation?
If we had to summarize, I'd say economy, safety, and companionship.
The house had everything they were looking for: space, enough privacy, and few stairs to avoid falls. Co-housing also means co-sharing the household bills.
We have $1,400 left to pay off the awning.
But co-housing goes beyond just being a practical financial arrangement.
It's cheaper to live with somebody else, but more importantly, it's better for our health, for physical health and for our mental health.
So, Mary, you're going to make 4 cups of chicken broth?
Back in London, the women say they're eating better and healthier than ever, and there's always someone around for a walk or a talk.
Dumping the onions in.
So no regrets?
No.
No, none whatsoever. No.
A couple of things I purged I wish I hadn't, but...
A small price to pay for continued health and companionship. Cass Roosey, CBC News, London, Ontario.
They said that they were trying to figure out who got the room in the basement with the extra room, the rumpus room in the living room, and they said it was the youngest person in there. It's kind of like the teenager in the family who gets that place. So she goes, I get the run of the whole basement to myself, and it's awesome. See, that what interested me about this story is that it's not just a story of three sweet ladies who decided to join together and live. There's a difference, I think, in joining together for the holidays and being with somebody so that you're not alone. There's a profound difference in actually selling your own home for the sake of investing and pooling your resources together, for budgeting together. You could tell they go to Costco a lot, I guess, on there. But this is this mentality, this paradigm shift that we push against the cultural norm of living by ourselves for the sake of something greater. Again, this idea of life together. They're both, the three of them there, two of them are widows, one of them is divorced, and they're actually telling the world that it's better to live together, and you can see the benefits of that as well. In our series, we're in this for 6 weeks, so get comfortable in this a little bit here, and I hope through this, some of it can be encouraging to us, and some of it challenging, but I hope through this, we don't say, some of us go, yes, check this off because I'm doing this, or I'm kind of in this place where I maybe should be, but I'm not, and so therefore I'm in this awkward, weird stage. I hope there's something encouraging and challenging for all of us wherever we're at. But I want us to see that as we become apprentices of Jesus, as we become intentional followers of him, that there's a crucial role that community plays in the thriving of the Christian life. There is a crucial role that community plays in the thriving of the Christian life. And what I mean by that, let me say it in another way. It's not just that we grow more as apprentices of Jesus if we live in community. It's that we were never designed to go it alone spiritually in the first place. So we can't say I would grow here by myself, but here within community. It's this paradigm of doing it alone was never intended. It was never Jesus' idea in the first place. Our central passage for our series is found in Acts chapter 2. We started there last week. We're going to continue probably every week to reread this verse over and over again. It's phenomenal. The group of Jesus followers, they see Jesus ascended, and then all of a sudden the Holy Spirit descends and starts starts doing amazing things. And this crowd starts forming, crowd of thousands of people. And suddenly Peter stands up, one of Jesus' followers, and just proclaims the greatness of Jesus. That he's God's son, that he's come to free us from our brokenness and heal us, and that he's risen and he's to follow. And we're told that 3,000 people decided that they wanted to follow Jesus Christ and be baptized. You see, we see that church here is not a place, but it's a people. 3,000 of them who just decided to follow Jesus from all walks of life. Every town and village and city in the surrounding area. Jews, non-Jews, who they called Gentiles. People of different race, language, wealth, and more. And it's interesting to note as I read this, what's the first mission as now these 3,000 plus people have gathered? What is their first mission? It's not, okay, let's get a building team together and decide what kind of building we should have a blueprint for and build. It's not, okay, let's design a Sunday school program for our kids. And it's not, let's get Alpha going. Or even, it's not this. Let's go out now and change the world. The very first task that the church has is to learn how to live together. In other words, their first mission is not task-orientated. Let's not do something. It's relationship-orientated. Acts 42, from 42 to 47, it says this. They, these new followers, devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And I love this. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. 3,000 people. You've got an instant megachurch by any standard. Instantly. So we're going to look at what seems to be a seemingly small act at the beginning of this passage, which turns out to be pivotal, not only for their existence as a brand new church, the very first church that has begun, but also setting the stage for every new church to come after this. It's these five words that, again, seem small and yet are profound. They devoted themselves to fellowship. We're going to be looking into different aspects of this passage in the weeks to come, but I want us just to sit and camp out for a little bit on these five words. They devoted themselves to fellowship. It was a radical new way of thinking for people. For the early believers to understand how to live, but also for the rest of the world to watch them. A bunch of people from different places who spoke different languages and dialects, who had different ways and beliefs and all these things, now we're starting to understand, how do we actually live together? So I want to take my time this morning to talk about the two radical ways that the early church lived. There's two that I see in these five words. Number one is that they saw themselves as family. Now, maybe you've come to church for a little bit and we talk about the family of God, and you know that it's a nice word that we come together and it's a term, but is it more of like an ideological term or is it a practical term? In other words, do we know after 5, 10 years of maybe if you've come to church for a while, you know the same 10 people, maybe 20 people if you're a social butterfly. But when you think about this, the early church literally saw themselves as family. Now, in this idea of Jewish culture in this time, the idea of a nuclear family was actually bigger than what we consider as a nuclear family today. Our nuclear family, we would generally say, statistically, mom and or dad, 2.5 kids, a dog, and a white picket fence. That's kind of our nuclear family. And then when we get together for the holidays or whatever, it's grandma and grandpa, it's aunt and uncles, it's the weird cousin from another town, you know, it's whatever, but they all get together. In this culture, that grander family was actually the nuclear family. So under one roof, you would have the weird cousin from another place, he came to live with you, you would have the aunt and uncles, even the grandparents, they would all be considered the nuclear family. Now think about this. Now 3,000 people begin to live in community, and they're suddenly seen as family. We know this because throughout the rest of the New Testament, in other words, from this point on, for the rest of the Bible, there are so many references to brothers and sisters in Christ. Brothers do this, and sisters and brothers. There's all these instructions, but they are termed this, not as a pat on the back, hey brother, how you doing, but almost literally. Like they had to think about this and go, I see this person right beside me, maybe in your row, not as a friend or not as a stranger, but as literally my brother or sister. This was radical for them. This was way more than just kind of sharing a membership to a common place like Costco. This was a radical, non-exclusive inclusion of all people. Now, they still lived in their own homes. It doesn't say they all sold their homes quite as much as these three women that we watched. They still legally owned their own things. And I think it's important to note this. In other words, they didn't all become a bunch of communists or live in the same commune for the sake of the common good. They lost their independence and individuality. They didn't, not at all. But they lived in something radical in that they saw each other now as family. This would have been a radical shift. Now, when you think about the practicalities of this, do you think everybody got along all day? Do you think everybody just smiled and said, good day to you, good day to you? Hey, hug, bring it in, you know, and everybody's just happy and joyful and singing songs all the time? I don't think so. I don't think they're much different than us as far as our individuality and our personalities. I am positive that out of those 3,000 plus people, that there were some with very strong personalities and some with very non-strong personalities. There were very opinionated people and very easygoing people. People who liked to be tidy and people who never just seemed to give a care. I'm sure there were people who liked to be 5 minutes early to meetings, while for others being 10 minutes late was kind of like being 5 minutes early for them. And it grated on those who were always early. In other words, there was petty conflicts and differences in the people all the time. But like I said, they had to learn, this was their first task, had to learn how to live together. And guess what? Doesn't this sound a lot like our families? Think about it for a moment. Is there anyone in your family that kind of bugs you? And I don't want to ask you to put your hand up on this because they might actually be in the same room here right now. Or you're kind of like, how about sometimes? Yes, definitely sometimes. Absolutely. So how did the Jesus followers do this? How did they almost put aside all of their differences in personalities and outlook and the way that they saw conflict and all these types of things? How did they still see themselves as family? Devotion. They devoted themselves to the fellowship, to this idea of, it's this term koinonia, this common good. In other words, it wasn't just me at the epicenter of life and my happiness, but I'm living not only for me, but also for the person next to me. And if I'm partly responsible for their joy in life, there has to be devotion. There has to be this sense of sacrifice for a higher good than me. devotion, doing something for a greater cause. We know all too well what this is about, and it leans in towards our passions. The Sun Run is starting. As far as training, it started last week, and there's a number of groups that start training again, interestingly enough, in community, because they know that joining in community and training is much easier than just giving people a worksheet and a task sheet of when to run and go for it. And so they join together. Why? Because it's easier to get motivated when other people are doing something higher than what simply you see. But training for the Sun Run is kind of like the devotion to people. Sometimes it's actually really easy, and sometimes it's not. When Michelle and I started dating in college, it was really easy to be devoted to Michelle. It was very easy to go to my way to make her happy and surprise her and do things. But then there's someone at church years later when I'm a pastor, and they grate me because they confront me on things, and I don't like it. But I have to understand that we are part of the same group, and if we're under the same church, we're the same family. Devotion is hard. Just like the Sun Run. There are days when it's beautiful out and you're running, and there's maybe if you're a runner, you experience this thing called runner's high. You feel like you could run forever. And then there's some days where it's cold and it's maybe snowing or raining hard, and your bed is literally reaching out for you to come back in because it's much warmer there. And the only thing that pulls you out and gets your shoes on and get outside is devotion. The early church was devoted to each other. Years ago, we were introduced to this world called Middle Earth and a bunch of different types of people in this series called Lord of the Rings. These elves and these dwarves and these halflings called hobbits, and together with humans, trying to live mostly apart. They had their own places in the kingdom of Middle Earth, and they lived amongst their own people. But suddenly, and if you haven't seen the movie, I think it's been out long enough that I can kind of ruin it for you, all right? But what happens is this ring of power, I won't go long into this, but this ring of power is formed. It can fall into bad hands, and so therefore they want to destroy the ring of power. What takes place is these group of people, all from these different kingdoms, join together to get rid of this ring of power and destroy it. What's the movie called? It's called The Fellowship of the Ring. Now, they could have called it the Koinonia of the Ring. Probably wouldn't have had the same ring to it, no pun intended. But they called it the Fellowship of the Ring because these people, these dwarves and elves and hobbits, all had to get together and learn how to live together to be devoted to a higher cause. And some days were easy and some days were hard. But again, welcome to family. Fellowship of the Ring is such a great picture of the early church. It helps us see church in a different light. It's more than just a collection of individuals, but they were devoting themselves to fellowship. On good days and hard, they devoted themselves to the koinonia. And their cause was not to destroy a ring of power or even to destroy Rome. It was to learn to live together, to share things and appreciate each other's differences, and to go deeper together than they ever would have by themselves. That's awesome. Love that. No, it's good. Keep it going. It's, sorry, I don't mean to make fun. But the thing about family is that regardless of who they are, they're still family, right? You know, it's not like when we're young and we have a fight with our sibling or we don't like the way mom and dad do things, and so therefore we just pack up and we say, see you later, I'm going to go join a new family. We may try that. In fact, some people have said that, you know, their three-year-old has tried to do that, and they pack their teddy bear and their little backpack, and away they go, and they get down the road, and they watch them the whole time, and then they end up coming back, right? But what happens when two siblings fight? Go and make up. Go and say sorry to your sister. Go and make things right. Why? It's because you are family. It doesn't matter if you like each other all the time. It's because you are family. So make up and get along. To think of church as family is radical. To think of it as a collection of a group of friends here and there, that's fine. To think of it as a place where I'm going to come and worship Jesus and maybe learn something from the Bible and go home for my week and it sets me straight is great. But to think of it as family is radical And yet, this is what the early church did. Now, when I say this, I get there's a fundamental difference between this church in Acts and us today. The big difference is this. They didn't have the privilege of church shopping back then. There was 3,000 plus people, and it was them. This was it. There was no church that started two blocks down that tried to, you know, is the worship better over there? Is the preacher more compelling over there? I think I'm going to go check out that. It was just them, and they had to learn how to live together. And I get it. In our culture here today, in Metro Vancouver, we literally have hundreds of churches. Hundreds of churches. Here's the thing. We can't attend all of them. It would take us a long time to attend all of them. But I think Jesus' way was not that we would attend all of them and kind of be like a rock skipping the surface of the water, kind of taking a little bit out of things as we go along. I think Jesus' idea was saying this. We can't pick every church, so pick one. And as you do, dig some roots down and build some roots there. No church is perfect, just like every family. But as you dig roots down, you'll find that you feel a sense of belonging more, and you will feel the sense of hopefully family more. And so I'm going to say this bold thing, and say this. If this is not your place for you, it's okay. I may go home and cry this afternoon, but it is okay. What I am saying is this. If it is, that's awesome. But find a place that you can call home as fast as you can, understanding that church is like family, which is never perfect. But as you start digging some roots down and they start growing, you will flourish in your walk with Jesus as an apprentice faster than you will by church shopping for a long time. We had someone here who, their first week, and I won't call them up by name, but their first week, they started to get to know a number of people. Very easygoing couple. They're not like people who stay up till 2 in the morning and have people over every night and they're just extroverts to the nth degree. They're just very nice, you know, people. By week 2, they were serving here, and they told me they wanted to start serving so that for the express purpose of getting to know people. I'm like, wow, like, you guys are real, right? Like, this is awesome. And now they're very much a part of our church community because they've taken steps forward towards that. Now, of course, we've taken steps forward as well. I'm not saying it's all on you to get to know people, and it's your responsibility. It's our responsibility. But please don't look for a church that will fit every single box that you have set up because you will church shop for the rest of your life. But instead, as you do that, build your roots. Step up and serve. Because that not only serves the family, but it helps you get to know people. Get involved in a life group. Try to begin seeing church as a family instead of a place to go once a week. And here's the beauty of this. I see this happening a lot here in our Yorkson community. We're 2 years in. We are relatively a young family. We're still trying to get to know each other, the people who have come 2 years, and those who have come less than that. So we're trying to do this, but we're not trying to have the best setup in town. We are trying to understand how we can live together in community and move towards serving our community to the glory of Jesus forever and ever, the best way we can. But I want to tell you, it's happening. I see it. And I can't mention all of the ways that I see it, but I do want to mention a few. So if you're not mentioned in this, please don't be offended. But I want to show you and highlight a few ways this is happening, that people are building roots. I see it in the people who are the first ones here and the last ones to leave, in setting up this environment that we can have. We believe, actually, the environment that we have here is a spiritual issue, not just a physical issue. It's kind of almost like in the sense of, we celebrate being together, and so why not set the place up as such? You know, normal family dinners are kind of like, let's just throw the plates on the table, and if you're lucky, if you have matching cups, because it just, who cares, in a sense. But we want to set it up here in case someone visits and goes, this is a beautiful place. I feel more inclined. I can see you put effort into this. And we believe it's important to celebrate and celebrate well by decorating and hosting an environment. But there are people here who get up faithfully every second week. At 7 a.m., they're here, and they leave after everyone has gone home to make sure that all of this stuff can be stored properly and brought out. It's our tech people and worship people. The worship people often practice one night a week so that they can come and be better prepared to help lead us to sing about Jesus better and more skilled, and allow us that place where we can just go, God, I reorientate my life to you. There are people who make coffee here so that coffee doesn't have that bad reputation of church coffee. Maybe you've been to a church, you go, yeah, that's church coffee. I know that feel, I know that taste. We have people here who make it specifically so that we can not have that and put out little creamers. You know, we could just throw the jugs down and say, here you go. But it looks fun back there. There's lights and it's awesome. People take effort in that. There's people who plan their lessons so they can teach our children not only about our good Heavenly Father, but that they can have fun doing it as well. And this is a radical shift on its own from some people who grew up in church and go, I never knew I could have fun in church. We're trying to show our kids that God is a God of fun. And there are people who lead life groups and are part of life groups. Understanding maybe we won't be family with everybody here, that would be kind of hard, but we can be family towards a group of maybe 12 or 14 people. That we can get to know each other, we can share life and hurts and anxieties and struggles and still be seen for who we are. We're going to get into that next week. But I love that we see that people are leaning into this idea that we are a family here. And if you're not, and maybe you're on the fringe or maybe you've been attending a little bit, but not a lot, that's okay. We're not asking you to, we're not going to join hands and sing Kumbaya in a few moments here. What I want to say is this, if you've been attending for a while and you feel like, yeah, you know what, I could plant here, do something to create community and see yourself and the people around you as family that we will never, or that we will get to know. The second way that we see this, that the church was radical, not only that they saw themselves as family, but that the believers spent lots of time together. Listen to this and hear how radical this new way of living as the early church saw it. One of the early church fathers by the name of Tertullian says this. He says, we as the early church, we have no compulsion to give. All giving is voluntary. People around us see how we give and say to those in need, how do we give to those in need and say this, see how they love each other. We do not hesitate to share everything we have with one another. We have all things in common but our spouses. Aptly said, that's good. Another early church father by the name of Justin Martyr says this. I love these quotes. He says, we used to, remember, this is way back. He says, we used to value getting wealth and possessions above all things. But now we bring what we have to a common fund and give to those in need. We used to hate and destroy one another and were racists. But now, since the coming of Christ, we live in harmony with people from other races and pray for our enemies. Isn't that beautiful? And you wonder, how did that happen? Yes, the Holy Spirit's at work and he's doing phenomenal things in and around people, but they had to learn how to live together. And as they, how they do that? They spent time together and they rubbed off on people. And the generous people started to rub off on the greedy people. And understanding this after a while, the greedy people became generous people. And the racist people became much less racist and became much more non-exclusive and open to everybody and started to pray for their enemies. Those whose hearts were full of anger started to release these things. Those who saw their possessions as only theirs began to see it as the communal. This ripple effect took place because of a natural influence on top of the work of the Holy Spirit. So who are you hanging around with? And is it rubbing off on you? We become like those that we naturally spend time with the most. We're not conscious of it all the time, but it does happen. I may have shared the story, so I apologize if I have, but it's about the flames, and so therefore I'd like to share it. My son, who's 12, said to me, I think it was last year sometime, he said this. I was putting him to bed one night, and he just said to me, and he's got his flames pillow and his flames posters up and a few things like that, but he just looked at me and in complete seriousness. He goes, Dad, isn't it so cool that we cheer for the same hockey team? He goes, think about this. He goes, there's 30 other teams that we could cheer for, and yet we both chose the same one. And I smiled inside, and I didn't want to ruin it for him that I actually controlled his mind since he was a young child. All I said to him was, isn't this phenomenal? Isn't that crazy, son? What a coincidence this is. You see, the best way we grow is in relationship, never just teaching. It's why we choose to get up out of our bed and gather in a group like this. It's why books were never alone meant to teach us and grow us spiritually. We always learn best in relational environments. In our college days, Michelle and I were talking about this, as good or bad as some of our classes were, our most memorable moments were not in a lecture, although some of them were maybe better or more remembering mindful than others, but our most opportunities to grow were spent in dorms, and were spent either playing pranks or talking about just general life or praying together or talking about how someone in our family is hurting or someone has passed away and someone is there to comfort them. That was the place where life really intersected with faith for us. And I think a lot of us would agree, the place for us to grow is more in relationship than ever any book was ever meant to. Tim Keller shared this information in a sermon. Tim Keller is a pastor in New York City of thousands, multi-site. And he said when he was at a church, just after he got to New York, he got invited back down to his church that he was spent a lot of time with in the South. And he said it was a 20 or 25 year ordination celebration for him. And so lots of people came together and celebrated Tim Keller. He was the center, the focal point of attention, and they had cake, and he said there was laughter and food, and there was music and all of this. But it got to a point where he said they stopped, and they had an open mic time, and they said, anybody who wants to come and just share what they've learned or been impressed or have been changed or influenced by Tim Keller, just come up to the mic and share. And Tim Keller didn't know this was happening, but he's kind of like shyly like, okay, this is great. And Tim Keller said he sat there, and one by one, everybody came up, and he said not one person talked about his sermons. Not one person mentioned his teaching. And he goes, no, don't get me wrong. He goes, I put my heart and soul into this, and this is my job. This is what I want to do, is teach the Bible. But he said the most profound effect that people said that I had on them was in places like when I went to the hospital because someone, a wife was there who's, she said, my husband's not going to make it out of the surgery. I need someone to pray with me. And he says, I was there. And they said, by you being there and praying with me, this meant the world to me. Or someone said, I just got laid off of a job and I don't know where I'm going to get our next paycheck. And you came to our house and you visited us and you brought a few gift cards with you, but more than that, your presence was here to remind us that God is God and that things will be okay. And he said there was just these continual circle of people, just these relational places where people were profoundly affected. And he said it reminded him that as much as important as his sermons were, that it's relationships where we grow most from. And so I just went, I don't think I have to plan another sermon again. This is great. Not at all. Of course, God's word is central, and it's what we want to learn from together. But we can't dismiss the relational environments in which we aspire or hopefully encourage to be a part of. And there's something beautiful that takes place when this happens. I want to just finish with this story. Another pastor, Daryl Johnson, former pastor and professor at Regent College. He shared about a traumatic time in his life. He had just started up here after spending years down in California as a pastor. And he said his son was in a hiking accident. Fell 60 feet off of a cliff face and was hanging on for life in a hospital. And he said hundreds of people came to visit him and pray with him and wish them well in their hospital. And he said, I'm appreciative and thankful for every single person who did. But he said there was this one group, it was our old life group, this group of 10 or 12 that got to know each other over a number of years. And he said what they did is they came by and he said to me this, of which I'll never forget. We just drove here and he goes, you guys live 2 hours away at my old church, like you're here or even a bit longer. He said, yeah, we all drove together as a life group. And we just wanted to let you know, we just went to your place. We cleaned it up. We stocked your fridge and freezer with food. And we put the key back because we knew where the key was. And we just wanted to let you know that we're praying for you and we love you. And he said he just started weeping because he said in a brand new way, amongst all of these people who are praying for him and wishing them well, he said he saw church in a whole new light. That it's this family, not just this gathering of individuals. And so my question for us today is, how do we view church? This idea of life together is beautiful when it starts to work and work well. And there are life groups that are thriving. Bonnie talked about hers, and it's just such a cool life group that it's joined of these girls of different and women of different stages of life, but joining together for this common purpose. They see themselves, I would guess, as family. And there's more. So I hope that would be something that you listen to and go, I don't know how to get there necessarily, but I want that. And we're going to be talking about how to get there soon. But what step can you take towards seeing church as a family, towards seeing it being life together?